allow these lands to be used for other purposes. We do not want to see that happen, but it will happen. Whether this bill passes or not, if that becomes a reality, it will happen. We are not, the people of this state are not, I don't believe, are going to allow 10 million acres of land, private property, to sit idle and not be allowed to be used for anything. So if the regulatory level ever got to the point where you really could not practice forestry profitably, then the pressure to change the land use laws to make these lands available for other uses would be enormous in our view. So this bill says that there are consequences and trade-offs to ever-increasing layers of regulation, and the trade-off means there's choices to be made. If the citizens of Oregon don't particularly like the timber industry, don't particularly like some of our practices, don't particularly like clear-cutting, they need to understand that the consequences of preventing us from doing those sorts of things are likely to be such that environmental degradation and the results of unbridled development and sprawl that would result from converting these lands to other uses would be much worse and have much greater negative impact on the quality of life in this state than allowing these lands to remain in forest use and allow us to practice forestry profitably. I might want to repeat what I said initially. This bill would only apply to future regulations. Our estimate, and the Department of Forestry has done similar estimates, it's hard to be really precise about it, but I think the figure is pretty close, that current regulations, the current Forest Practices Act and Forest Practices Rules we have to abide by, have basically taken roughly 7% of the private forest land base out of production. That's the cost of what we're currently living with. As one example of that, in fact, the major example probably is the buffers we have to leave along streams. Two sessions ago, the Legislative Revenue Office did a fiscal impact analysis of a bill that would have given us a tax credit for the trees that are left in stream buffers. And assuming that everybody took advantage of that tax cut that was eligible to do it, the estimate was that that would cost the state of Oregon $35 million a year. So that's the value of the timber that we're currently leaving behind every year in stream buffers on private property without a dime of compensation. We are not here today to complain about that. We think those regulations make sense. They are reasonable. They serve a public purpose that we think we need to do. And those existing regulations would not count in this bill. It'd only be regulations adopted in the future. So you're really talking about a potential impact of 17%. Only if 17% of a parcel of forest land was taken away would this bill kick in. In terms of what the impacts of passing this bill would be, we don't think in the foreseeable future that it's likely that the Board of Forestry, who administers the Forest Practices Act, is likely to double or triple the burden of the existing regulations. But as this committee heard a couple of weeks ago, heard evidence of, there are environmental activist groups who are increasingly targeting private land with some truly draconian proposals that would have severe impacts on the value of those lands. Some of these proposals are, in our view, irresponsible and simplistic. The arguments are emotional. Erroneous statements are made in support of them, but some folks accept that at face value. And we had an experience, you all know, we had an experience with that just last year in the ballot. There was a measure on the ballot that would have, if it had passed, would essentially have put us out of business. It would have taken 100% of the value of forest land away from us. Our members alone raised more than $3 million to defeat that proposal. That was an expensive endeavor, and if we have to do it again, we will. And it looks, based on the testimony you heard a couple weeks ago, that we may very well have to do it again. The outcome of that measure has not deterred those folks from talking about coming back with an alternative to that. And I think this ties back to House Bill 3227. Because the reality is, if Measure 64 had passed, or something like it passes in the future, one of two things are going to happen, or maybe both. Either the state of Oregon will be faced with prohibitive claims based on regulatory takings, which would bankrupt the state, or there will be, as I said earlier, enormous pressures to change the land use laws to allow those 10 million acres to be used for something else. House Bill 3227 will help us make that case, to help us communicate to the people of Oregon that this is not a free lunch. There are consequences to allowing the regulatory burden on private property to get too high. And I think one other thing it would do would help the state of Oregon resist equally draconian regulatory proposals coming from the federal government. We saw one of those last year. The National Marine Fisheries Service floated a proposal that would have taken 40% of the private land, forest land base out of production. If the state of Oregon could tell the feds, if we do this or if you do it, the land use laws are going to change and the impact on the environment is going to be much greater than allowing forest land to remain in forest use, I think that would be a helpful argument. We're seeing this already in other states. The state of Washington, where they don't have the kind of land use laws we have in Oregon, the regulations in that state, based on a recent proposal, if it goes through, are going to hit around the 15 to 17% mark. And the projections up there are you're going to see massive conversions of forest land into development and commercial and residential use. And that is, I guess, to wrap this up, Mr. Chairman, that's something that we don't see happen. We strongly support this system. We just want to make it clear that there are trade-offs and consequences on the regulatory side. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Wilkerson. It's interesting. We have really a little different concept here. In our society, we have one concept out there that if regulations go into effect that limit the use of your land, then society would somehow raise enough money to pay you for the not being able to use your land. That has been a concept that's floated around and is being looked at in other states. We have, even in Washington, there was bonds that were passed to keep green belts and that sort of thing where property owners were paid for the loss of use of their land in order to maintain their current use or to set it aside because they've lost it. In this case here, as I would understand it, if these things come into play, basically then you would override those regulations and be able to go on. And which regulations really are we looking at? We're looking at Forest Practices Act, land use planning. How would it affect federal requirements under the listing issue? Would those? How could we override those restrictions?
Mr. Chairman, it's an open question whether or not the federal government can directly regulate private property or private forest land through restrictive forest practices regulations. The more likely scenario is that they would pressure the state of Oregon to amend our state laws. We've seen that already. The proposal we saw from National Marine Fisheries Service last year was to the Board of Forestry, asking the Board of Forestry to change state administrative rules to restrict forestry practices along the lines they thought was appropriate. So that's that. If that was a scenario, then this proposal would affect that because this is an amendment to the Forest Practices Act.
It seems like though with the feds pushing that requirement, it would be hard for us to ignore that new Practices Act if it was being required under the Endangered Species Act.
Mr. Chairman, I think the effect of this bill, hopefully, what I just tried to say is that if this was on the books, it would be an argument that the state of Oregon could make back to the federal government suggesting that they might not want to push that on us because of the consequences.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ray, I strongly support private property rights and very concerned that the government continually places mandates on us and that people vote on issues that restrict the use of our land and thereby diminish its value. And I have no problems, even though I don't like that concept, I have no problems with the public, as in Washington State, putting forth their money with their vote to compensate a landowner for that. And so generally I support this idea. I do have concerns about how, because under Section 2 of the bill, it talks about the timber owner can prove that an application of a statute or rule has resulted in more than a 10% reduction. I know you have a mechanism for doing that now, but are we going to open that up to lawsuits based on an environmental group may come in and say this, you know, Willamette Industries in my area has a particular unit they want to harvest, and they say that it's been restricted more than 10%, and thereby this law is invoked. who's going to ultimately decide this? Are we going to tie this up in the courts? Are we going to have some judges or referees? What's the intent here?
Representative Krupp, as the chairman indicated, the language of this bill is taken directly from a bill that was before the legislature two sessions ago, Senate Bill 160, which was a private property rights bill related to private forest land that OFIC brought forward. Those kinds of questions were this. That was a major piece of legislation there was a lot of hearings and a lot of attention paid to, and a lot of discussion about those kinds of details. To answer your question, the burden would be on the landowner. It would be an appraisal process. I think it can be done, and that was the discussion we had 4 years ago. If the landowner was not able to establish that through a recognized appraisal process, then it would not be triggered.
And one more question, yes, Mr. Chair. Ken, what is on line 18 under section or paragraph B there? What does silvicultural prescription mean? I'm a farmer, sir.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Representative Krupp, that is forestry jargon, and I guess the best way to answer your question is by an example. Clear cutting would be a silvicultural prescription. So it's a manner of practicing forestry. It's a forest method.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Oberlaw.
Thank you. First, a comment and then some questions. One, you are optimistic, Ray, if you think you can actually have any influence in the federal government. They seem to do what they want to do regardless, but be that as it may. I have a problem here with the language, and maybe you can help me out. As both Section 2 in your discussion, you talked about that this only comes into play with rules that are imposed after the effective date. However, if you look at Section 2, if you look at the first line of Section 2 on line 6, it says, if you can prove that the application of a statute or a rule, we're not just talking about rules, we're also talking about statutes, but yet there's no clarifying language after that if we're talking about statutes that are in effect now or later. So if you can address that.
Representative Erbilaw, that's a good point. I hadn't noticed that before, and that certainly wouldn't be the intent. If the committee chooses to move this legislation, I think that would need to be clarified.
Okay. Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I went and read all the ORSs that are referred to in line 10 and 11, and the majority of them really deal with dwelling houses and so forth on land. So basically, how I read this, if you could go in and prove that 10% or more of your property had been affected in its use, that you could sell off the entire property or just the 10% affected, again, that's not clear, to open it up to development, that type of thing.
Representative Erbilaw, it would be the entire parcel. It would be hard to pinpoint a section of that if you're required to leave 30 trees per acre, for instance, that would have more than a 10% impact, then, if this bill wasn't in effect, you'd have to select those trees. So it would be the harvest unit that would be affected by this.
Another question. We have a lot of different timber activities here. We have the large commercial timber. We have the small woodlands. 10% of a small woodlands lot may be a fair amount. 10% of some of the big commercial places, commercial activities, isn't really going to be that much in the overall scheme. But this would apply in all situations, regardless of what your acreage was in timber. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Erbilaw, and I'll acknowledge that 10% is a relatively arbitrary number, but again, it would be added to the 7 already, so we're talking about a 17%, and I guess if that was deemed to be all right, I guess rhetorically I would ask back, what level would be appropriate? How much value of private property is it appropriate for the state to take without compensation or without any consequences?
Thank you.
Ms. Ray, looking at this whole issue and remembering back Senate Bill 160 and on page 4 of your handout here, you have some, one of the members have looked at that, talks about Senate Bill 160. I was on that committee in 1995 when we looked at that whole issue. It was a major piece of legislation. There was more to it, and he has some suggestions there that were part of Senate Bill 160. And knowing that that bill was vetoed, we came back, we tried to override the veto, didn't we? I believe we tried to override the veto, and that failed.
That's correct. It was a Senate bill, so it went to the Senate first, and there was 19 votes to override the veto, one short.
This was a big deal. This late in the session, what would be, you know, where would we go with an issue this late in the session in reality?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's late in the session only based on the committee's, the schedule for committees to hear bills. I think we've got a couple months left in the session, so if the process could accommodate this, it's not like we're going to adjourn tomorrow. I mean, that's up to you. I mean, I acknowledge this. We brought this fairly late to you, and the reason was we discussed it at length internally with our board of directors about whether or not we wanted to bring this forward, so that took some time.
What are the chances if this were theoretically to go all the way through that it wouldn't be vetoed again?
I wouldn't want to speak for the governor, Mr. Chairman. There's some other folks that I think have signed up to testify on this from the agencies, and might get a indication from them.
We can bring this back on Thursday and talk about it some more. We're going to have to not spend too much time. The session's at 11 today. We do have one more bill here we need to talk about. Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would point out to the committee that at 10% actually is quite generous, and the landowner would actually do quite much better if the state would go in and condemn, because at condemnation, the requirement is to pay 100% of fair market value. So I would just point out that when we're looking at a 10% value here that the landowners would be getting, that's actually pretty generous from the standpoint of the landowner, to the landowner allowing that to the state. And they could take it.
I have five people signed up here against this bill, Ray.
I'm outnumbered.
Yes.
Thank you.
Would all five of you like to come up and just briefly state, who you are? And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. We need to do, we'll give you maybe 10 minutes here. And just, I don't know.
Are we going to go to the other bill?
We're
going to go to the other bill.
Yeah, we need to run the other bill yesterday. We shouldn't. Everybody can look at that other bill. We've had the hearing on that other bill. It has to do with senior citizens. We shouldn't have to spend a lot of time on that bill. Just state your name and don't read 4 pages of testimony. If you have testimony, you can hand that out. But basically, maybe you can remind us a little of the issue on 160 and just in your own words. So where do you want to start out? Bob, you want to start out? Bob Rindy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As I understand this bill, the circumstances of the 10% reduction would immediately mean that all the state land use goals would be withdrawn from the property. And I think the committee needs to understand that the state land use goals do so many things that maybe people aren't thinking of here. They require citizen involvement in terms of land use decisions made with respect to that property. They protect riparian zones, and this is a crucial part of the Oregon plan for salmon. They require local governments to have regulations regarding floodplains and other natural hazards. These are just some of the things that we would be removing in terms of state oversight from local government land use planning because of this reduction. Most likely, the effect of this is going to be that these forest properties will be developed with residential uses. Could be very intensive residential uses, could be destination resorts, because Goal 14 wouldn't apply. These lands could be developed with intensive commercial uses. I can imagine that circumstance occurring in some areas. I also, in my letter, point out it's our understanding, and I imagine the Department of Forestry and others can give you a better sense of this, but that the Forest Practices Act, which states that it cannot be used to prevent a change in use, and in the past it's been our understanding that if someone is changing the use of land, then the FPA, in some circumstances or in many circumstances, no longer applies. So we point out that, for example, if the Forest Practices Act is requiring a buffer strip to protect the salmon spawning area, that results in a 10% reduction of the timber on the property. That means the land use goals don't apply, and that means that the use changes on that property, which means the Forest Practices Act doesn't apply, which means you lose the entire property plus the buffer. And I don't know that that was the intent of the proponents, but I see that as a real problem in terms of what could happen if this legislation is adopted. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions, President Cuomo?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just ask, with regards to the Forest Practices Act, and if it did in bring up a over 10% taking. And we heard testimony earlier that statewide the buffer protection was about a $35 million hit on the landowners. Who should absorb that $35 million? The landowner, or should the state be absorbing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cremel, I'm not really qualified to answer who should, and in fact, I'm sure that you could write a bill with a variety of remedies for that. I'm just here to point out that rather than a remedy that might authorize some additional use of the property or some other kind of remedy, I think the remedy here of just elimination of all state land use regulations, I think it will have many unintended consequences, and we would urge that if you do feel there's a remedy, that you come up with some different remedy.
From the Department of Forestry, can you give us a little take on this issue of whatever your involvement is? Were you around when we had Senate Bill 160?
Yes, I was. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, Assistant State Forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm presenting this testimony for Ted Lawrenson, who's the Program Director for Forest Practices, who was unable to be here. As we understand, the purpose of this bill is to provide regulatory stability. Understandably, with ballot measure 64 in the recent history and other potential proposals looming, that landowners are frustrated and concerned about the costs and the threats to their livelihood. If new forest practices would regulations reduce the value by more than 10%, then no land use regulation would apply. The Board of Forestry is very much in favor of stabilization of regulation, but they feel very strongly about conserving the forest land base. Now, there is a part of Senate Bill 160 that did survive, and that is one that requires, prior to adopting rules that would restrict timber harvesting, that the board must make a number of findings. One, that the proposed rule reflects available science and monitoring. Two, that feasible alternatives, including non-regulatory alternatives, would be considered. And three, that the benefits of the resource are in proportion to the degree that existing practices are contributing to the problem. There are going to be major problems if you do see land use regulations going away. For example, the impact on wildfire, we're likely to see larger, more expensive, and more dangerous wildfires, increased parcelization, subdivision development, increased conflicts, which then affect adjacent ownerships, loss of habitat, and loss of jobs as a result. We have an issue before the legislature right now that is a clash between land use and forestry, and that is in the the landslide legislation and development and the problems that are caused there. This would cause, if it is triggered to go into place, I think a downward spiral in the loss of our forest resources. It would also affect our flexibility in trying to deal with Threatened and Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act, where we're trying to perhaps offset any proposed federal regulations or proposed listings. In summary, we support trying to have regulatory stability for landowners, but the impact of this bill should cause irreparable loss of our forest resources. The board believes very strongly, as does the department, that we need to have a climate statewide where landowners can willingly invest in their land so that we have both productive as well as healthy forests. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that, let's see, Jeff here at the table here.
Thank you.
Watkins, Sierra Club.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jeff Watkins here today on behalf of the Sierra Club Oregon chapter. And just as a general big picture viewpoint from us, we feel that this bill is an attempt to unfairly shield the timber industry from their share of the burden of to help restore salmon in particular and to protect public resources in general. Assuming that this bill were to pass, there would be a 10% cap on the industry share, while all other Oregonians would have to make up the difference in efforts to recover salmon and abide by rules and statutes and regulations that are designed to protect public resources and salmon habitat. For example, farmers, sport and first and commercial fisheries, manufacturers, urban water and sewer ratepayers, residential and commercial developers will all have to unfairly bear that burden that the timber industry has escaped. And I think if you kind of start down the slope, you kind of have to ask the question, what if all these other groups ask for the same type of treatment? And that would just be kind of an interesting question to ponder for a little while. And just as a general principle, the Sierra Club thinks that the legislature should resist attempts to bestow special treatment or exemptions from policies and goals that all other citizens are expected to work towards. Sierra Club urges a no vote on House Bill 327. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Yes. Mm-hmm. As I looked at this bill and I thought about it in terms of your presentation, well, your the presentation, but the presentation of what might possibly happen with the initiative process next election. One of the great failings, I think, of our initiative process is there's never any information in the initiative of the financial impact, whoever is having the initiative. And I'd just like to have your thought on, as you come up with whatever your initiative would you be willing to have a financial statement on there, an impact, so people who are voting on it know exactly what they're voting for and what the outcome would be?
Mr. Chair, Representative Werbelow, that's a very good question. A couple things. First, the proposed ballot measure is not a Sierra Club ballot measure.
Right.
But I think you have a good point about that's a key piece of information that I think voters should have as a part of the information that they have when they're making decisions. What is going to be the fiscal impact on? Usually that question is in terms of the state. I think in here you're asking what would be the private impact on.
I don't care who it's on.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's an important piece of information. And, I can't answer yes or no whether we'd have that in there. But I think the other side of that is, of course, what has been the cost that the industry has shifted on to others in terms of lost habitat, in terms of the lost soils, salmon habitat, things like that. So if you go down that road, you have to be fair and ask all the questions about who's paying what cost.
Okay.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, just briefly, if the new coho listings impact the streams that I irrigate out of and farm next to, and I have to start using buffer zones where I cannot farm next to them for whatever reasons they deem, and that causes me economic loss, what is wrong with the concept of the government, which is placing a regulation upon me, compensating me for that loss? Because I worked hard to buy that land and pay for it with tax-paid dollars. Now I cannot utilize it in the manner that which I have been, and I think I should be justly compensated for that. And if the government's not responsible for that, and would the Sierra Club be willing to pay me for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, probably not directly out of our funds, but,
okay.
But you know, it's kind of go back to the question Representative Werbelow had. The whole issue of who's paying the cost is a very interesting one that we all spend a lot of time on. And undoubtedly, if restrictions come down and buffer zones or regulations on the amount of water you use, you're obviously going to be able to analyze that and say, this is the bottom line, this is what it's going to cost me. And we're not going to deny that that costs you. But again, what the other side of that is what costs have been shifted to others. And I don't want to speak formally on behalf of the Sierra Club, but I think that if the industry were to ask nicely for some support of some groups about tax credits or things like that, they might get some takers. And, you know, the exchange for that would be there'd have to be meaningful regulations. Now, I don't know about 100% of the cost or 50% of the cost or 25% of the cost, but I feel that some conservation organizations would be willing to seriously consider that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Thompson, then Representative
Mr. Chair, this is always an interesting argument, but if you're going to carry it that far in the farm industry or the forest industry or cities impacted the fish and caused the loss of the fish, and the fishermen have traditionally fished on those fish and in a biologically sound manner, does that mean that you guys are going to compensate the fishermen for the loss of income? Because there was a major industry in this state, and we've been virtually taken down to almost non-existence, and we've quit fishing on them, but it's obvious that that's not the cause of the demise of these fish. A lot of our things that caused it were caused by other users. So, I mean, compensation is an interesting thing that can be reflected, and if you're going to pass out money, I want to put my hand up versus the fisherman.
I think we'll move to Representative Deckard with that.
Well, Mr. Chair, my point is directed at the panel, but I want my hand in the air, too, on Representative Krupp's point, because I guess taxes are just going to have to go through the roof, because I have a stream that runs behind my house, and it's on my property, and I would love to, I like to golf, I'd love to chip and putt, or I'd love to develop that in some way, but it would destroy that stream for everyone else that lives upon it, and so I'm into the conundrum. But if we're going to go into this realm, then I want compensation also for my stream. I don't know who's going to pay these increased taxes to do that, but if that's the arena that we're in, then I certainly want to be compensated for the restrictions that are on my private property.
Well, Representative Deckard, I would be more than willing to introduce legislation as a priority bill to allow people in the state of Oregon who want their taxes raised to pay higher taxes. And the rest of us who don't have to.
If we're going to force regulation, if we're going to force compensation, I just want in on my compensation.
Let's move along. We have two other people here we'd like to hear from. Thank you very much for coming, Ann and Bob and Jeff, Charlie Swindles, Thousand Friends, Oregon.
Never get it right.
Go ahead, Charlie. You're there at the mic. And then we have Glenn Spain, Pacific Coast Federation and Fishermen's Association. Go ahead, Charlie.
Okay. Chairman Welch, ahead, members of the committee, Charlie Swindles, on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, I just have two brief points. The first point is actually to echo the sentiments of the proponent, Ray Wilkerson, although 1,000 Friends opposes the bill. Obviously, there is a kind of an indirect or inferential relationship between the land use planning goals as they relate to forest land, which are to preserve the forest land base, and then forest practices, which the Forest Practices Act, which is to manage how that commercial activity takes place. We are invited many times, but resist at all costs the urge to get involved in the forest practices debate, just like the agricultural practices debate, but nevertheless, we sought and obtained approval from our board of directors to oppose ballot measure 64 during the last election. We did so because that ballot measure just seemed to us to preclude all or virtually all forest management, and we felt, well, if our conservation agenda is premised on continued resource use of that land and this ballot measure is going to preclude that resource use, we're just going to have to oppose that ballot measure. This House bill, on the other hand, though, doesn't contemplate an entire cessation of forest uses, and we're not able to say that categorically and prospectively a 10% reduction is something that's passing out to a Measure 64 or something like that. And my second comment is in response to points raised by Representative Kummel and Representative Croft. In my legislative career for three sessions now, I've dealt with this issue of landowner compensation, and it's a really, really hard thing for me personally. It's causing a lot of distress. But the problem that I've had with proposals here in Salem have been an attempt to define legislatively that prospectively this following threshold shall in all cases be something that constitutes a taking or something that triggers compensation or something that relieves a landowner from certain regulatory burdens and so forth. There's just too many cases that I've seen in my own career where two side-by-side situations, circumstances would warrant different treatment when a landowner's responsibilities in one case may merit, for example, a 10% reduction, where in another case that may be more onerous and maybe would not merit applying the regulation or would merit compensation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Glenn, welcome.
Yeah, but for the record, my name is Glenn Spain. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, which is the largest federation of commercial fishing families on the West Coast. We opposed this in session before last very strongly, as did every other major fishing organization in Oregon. It would bring chaos to the practice of forestry. It would undercut the ability of a designated state agency, which has far more expertise on this than most others, to manage forestry, that is the Board of Forestry, which by and large does a pretty good job, in my opinion, of balancing the various interests. This is also designed to undercut public property rights. There is a very strong need to protect public property rights. That means the water supply that many of our major cities use, which come from forests, fisheries, which amount to jobs in coastal communities all up and down the coast, fish and wildlife, which are public resources, and also the forest land base itself. Now, the unintended consequence of this is that, if you read the statute, let me look at it this way. The closest analogy I could come to, not original, is if I'm going to be 10 minutes late to a meeting because of the speed laws, I get to waive the speed laws forever. Essentially, what that amounts to here is that if you can demonstrate in some fashion that 10% of the value of your timber has been reduced, and those values, by the way, have fluctuated by as much as 600%, just stumpage prices alone in the past decade, so it could go up and down all the time. Then you get to waive all the land use restrictions. Now, if I were a developer, I'd go out and buy bottom land, forest land, divide it up so that I had the most valuable parcels with at least 10% restrictions, like riparian areas, and sell the hell out of them. I mean, this is what would, it would be a rush to the bank. I don't believe that the authors have thought it through. I sympathize very strongly, having been a small timberland owner myself, with the intent, but this isn't going to get us there. It simply isn't going to work. What it will do is freeze rules that are continually in need of revision, and really have a chilling effect on the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry making rules that protect resources. It will allow landowners to waive the very state laws that protect them from having to be sued in a federal court under federal law, under the Clean Water Act. Most courts defer to states if the states have a bona fide protective mechanism, then it can accomplish the same thing. The Oregon plan, for instance, is in place now because National Marine Fisheries Service saw that we were making good headway. The complaint the courts had was that we didn't have enough protections in the law. This just makes it worse. The other thing is it would embroil the industry in continuous litigation. Okay. Proof is what? A battle of experts in court. It would probably encourage more initiatives because all you have to do in an initiative is say X and X provision that this implies is overruled. I mean, that's what it would do, is it would create chaos, it would deplete our forest land base, and I agree 100% with the department, and this is why the department has chosen to oppose it.
Thank you. We need to be moving on, Lance. You're about done there. I appreciate you coming. I'm going to close the hearing on 3227. Thank you all for coming and testifying on this. We do want to quickly get through this last bill. This is a bill we've heard before. This is an open hearing, a work session on 2372. This is Representative Byer's bill. Could you briefly explain, Representative Byer, what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, this bill is the bill that would change the time of residency requirement to receive a resident senior hunting or hunting and angling. I'll make sure I got both in here. Anglers on the second
page. It says
free
hunting and angling.
Hunting and angling. Currently, it's 5 years. This would take it to 15 years. This committee just passed House Bill 2100 on the Ways and Means, which does something different than this with these people. So there would be a conflict between this and House Bill 2100. With that, we're in work session. I move House Bill 2372 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'd like to have Harrison, we talked about on our staff measure summary. What are some of the issues we discussed last time?
One of the things that Representative Byer mentions is that this would treat the senior citizen hunting and fishing license differently than House Bill 2100. In that bill, the residency requirement is still 5 years, but that license is going to go to half of the regular price. There was discussion in the last meeting, and I was not your administrator at that time, so I put this together from the record. There was discussion at that time that these senior citizens self-certify their age and their residency, and that would be true under this bill as well. That's not a change. There was also a discussion, and Mr. Rollator may be able to help us with that. Apparently, if there is a charge for a license, we get some sort of a federal match for fish restoration, I believe. If we do not charge at this point, there is no federal payment, although I understand that perhaps in the case where we have a tag attached to a license, we may still qualify for that federal money.
Joe, welcome again on this bill. Would you like to address that issue if we charge the seniors half price and we could get matching funds? And where do we want to go with this issue with seniors?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I'm the assistant to the director of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As Representative Byer has pointed out, this is a different way of approaching the situation than we approached in 2100. We issue about 4,000 licenses per year. Free licenses to the senior citizens. These are mostly the combination hunting and fishing licenses. About 30 to 40% of those people that we issue those licenses to are residents in this period of time between 5 and 15 years. So we would increase our revenues by 30 or 40%. Based on those would be the licenses that we would now sell and not issue free. And additionally, we would pick up the revenue from the federal excise taxes that are rebated based on license sales for those extra 1,000 or so people per year. So not only would we gain the cost of the combination license, we'd pick up the extra $5 to $6 per year per license that we get from the federal government. We see this as a different way of handling this issue of free licenses, and I think the department can support this way as well as our way, and we're fine with this.
Members, I think if you have your House Bill 2100, you look on page 4. House Bill 2100, page 4, line 12. It seems to be, what do we have, a different section of the statute there, or let's see, what? It isn't quite the same language, is it? 497, yeah, that's 497.121, and we're looking at 497.102. different.
Mr. Chair, no, it's the same.
No.
I believe if both, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Barnes.
I believe if both these bills were to pass, and Joe may correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe both these bills were to pass at that point in time. Residents who have been in the or here for more than 15 years would then get one half off of their license.
My notes indicate from my previous testimony. Why do we have two different places in the statute here that we're talking about resident annual senior citizens?
Mr. Chair, if you go to section 4, page 4, 102.
Section 4, page 4 is amending 497.102.
And that's also what's being amended in section 1 of 2372.
Okay. Section 2, though, of 2372 is 497.121.
And if you look at section 6 of 2100, that is also section 497.121. You have fishing licenses in one section and hunting licenses in another.
That's correct.
So the effect, as I said, Mr. Chair, the effect of both of these bills if passed together would be that a 15-year resident of Oregon over the age of 70 would then get a one-half price license.
Oh, I see. The this is the hunting. This is the hunting license area in 102.
And
I need to be on page six. I need to be on page six.
Yes, page six also.
Motion to pass. You made a motion.
So what? Your proposal was one half of the fee imposed.
I accept that motion.
Could you say again, Joe, what you just said a while ago?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm sorry, what would you like clarification?
Where are we now in tying these two issues together?
If Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, and I'm not from Legislative Council, so I can't tell you this for sure, but as I understand it, Representative Byer's bill deals with when you issue these pioneer licenses that are now free, senior licenses that are now free. And under our present system, they have to be 70 years old and 5-year residents. Under Representative Byer's system, they'd have to be 70 years old and 15-year residents. 2100 deals with how much that license costs the person. Representative Byer leaves the present system in place of a free license for a senior. Our 2100 makes a senior license half price. So if both of these bills were to pass, a senior license would be available to 70-year-olds who have been residents for 15 years or more, and that license, and assuming that both bills pass, then that senior license would cost half price. If 2100 does not pass, Representative Byers does, then a senior license would go to anybody who's been a resident for more than 15 years, and it would be free.
So I don't see we have a conflict here.
No,
really.
Sir. As I understand it, and I, yeah. I don't. I think
everybody with us now. We really don't have a conflict. If 2100 passes, then they're going to get half of the fee, but those people are still going to. Then the other one doesn't pass, they'll still stay under the 5 years. If both of them pass, then it'll be 15 years, and they'll still get half.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Joe and I have talked about this a lot, but and I think I can safely speak for seniors, although I'm not 70 yet. But I don't think seniors should be given any break by the virtue of the fact they're seniors. I think, if anything, it should be means tested if that's what we're going to do. However, if both this and 21 pass, then we were at least getting half price from them. And I will vote it out, but it's always bothered me that we gave freebies to people who could well afford it, in many cases even more afford than the younger person fishing and so forth.
Okay, we're in work session on House Bill 2372. Representative Byer, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2372 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion of the motion?
Yes.
Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I want to make sure I understand this. The one part of all of this that I am opposed to is the 15-year as opposed to the 5-year. If I vote for 2372, that will impose the 15-year on 2100?
It will impose a 15-year before they can get a senior license, right. Either free or discounted, depends on what happens.
Right. So if I'm in favor of only the 5-year, I need to vote against.
You need to vote against the bill.
Any other clarification?
Nancy, I'd like to call the roll, please. Yes. He's excused.
Yes.
Aye.
No.
No.
Yes.
Representative Thompson is here now.
Yes.
House Bill 2372, receiving majority votes, is declared passed. Representative Byer, I'd like to carry your bill. Representative Byer, Chair of Hobson. Representative Hobson was a no. With that, thanks for the good work today. We'll close the hearing, work session on 2372, and close